You're listening to Jenny Finch, crime writer, scholar, and commentator, with another classic Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting. Crime writer, that means she authors the crimes, she's the mastermind behind the crimes. Oh, is this recording?
This month's book is Cannery Row by John Steinbeck. Written in 1945 on his return from active service in the Second World War, Cannery Row is John Steinbeck's homage to an area in California that he loved. The book is set in Monterey, in a small coastal community famous for its fishing and home to the sardine canning industry for the region during the Great Depression. Cannery Row is a poor but close-knit community, perhaps somewhat idealised, as Steinbeck looks back on the place where he spent some of the happiest times of his life. It has only a very flimsy central story. A group of men, known as Mac and the Boys, try to give Doc, who owns a lab on the street, a party to thank him for all the help and kindness he's shown them. Unfortunately, things get out of hand, and they almost destroy Doc's lab. Desperate to make amends, the men plan an even bigger and better party for him. Surrounding this plot are the lives and stories of other residents: the Chinese grocer Lee Chong, Dora, who runs the bawdy house, graced with the title The Bear Flag Restaurant, and a host of others. Often they're almost sketched in, described in a sentence or two, but somehow the author's writing seems to bring them to life vividly with the minimum of words.
Weston Biological was right across the street and facing the vacant lot. Lee Chung's grocery was on its catty corner right, and Dora's Bear Flag restaurant was on its catty corner left. Weston Biological deals in strange and beautiful wares. It sells the lovely animals of the sea, the sponges, tunicates, anemones, the stars and bottle stars and sun stars, the bivalves, barnacles, the worms and shells, the fabulous and multiform little brothers, the little moving flowers of the sea, nudibranchs and testibranchs, the spiked and knobbed and needly urchins, the crabs and demi-crabs, the little dragons, the snapping shrimps and ghost shrimps so transparent that they hardly throw a shadow. And Weston Biological sells bugs, and snails, and spiders, and rattlesnakes, and rats, and honeybees, and Gila monsters. These are all for sale. Then there are little unborn humans, some whole and others sliced thin and mounted on slides. And for students there are sharks with the blood drained out, and yellow and blue colour substituted in veins and arteries, so that you may follow the systems with a scalpel. And there are cats with coloured veins and arteries, and frogs the same. You can order anything living from Weston Biological, and sooner or later, you will get it. It is a low building facing the street. The basement is the storeroom with shelves, shelves clear to the ceiling, loaded with jars of preserved animals. And in the basement is a sink and instruments for embalming and for injecting. Then you go through the backyard to a covered shed on piles over the ocean, and here are the tanks for the larger animals, the sharks and rays and octopi, each in their concrete tanks. There is a stairway up the front of the building, and a door that opens into an office where there is a desk piled high with unopened mail, filing cabinets, and a safe with the door propped open. Once the safe got locked by mistake, and no one knew the combination. And in the safe was an open can of sardines and a piece of Roquefort cheese. Before the combination could be sent by the maker of the lock, there was trouble in the safe. It was then that Doc devised a method for getting revenge on a bank, if anyone should ever want to. "Rent a safety deposit box," he said. "Then deposit in it one whole fresh salmon, and go away for 6 months." After the trouble with the safe, it was not permitted to keep food there any more. It is kept in the filing cabinets. Behind the office is a room where in aquaria are many living animals. There also are the microscopes and the slides and the drug cabinets, the cases of laboratory glass, the workbenches and little motors, the chemicals. From this room come smells. Formalin and dry starfish and seawater and menthol. Carbolic acid and acetic acid, smell of brown wrapping paper and straw and rope, smell of chloroform and ether, smell of ozone from the motors, smell of fine steel and thin lubricant from the microscopes, smell of banana oil and rubber tubing, smell of drying wool socks and boots, sharp, pungent smell of rattlesnakes, and musty, frightening smell of rats.
The book is populated by the unemployed, the unemployable, drunks and prostitutes, yet there is no sense of moral outrage or implied criticism towards the inhabitants of Cannery Row. Despite being a light-hearted and comedic book, Cannery Row still shows Steinbeck's concern for the dispossessed and the downtrodden that is such a strong theme in his more serious works. There is conflict, injustice, compromise, loss and love, all crammed into a book the size of a modern novella. Many of the chapters are a scant 5 or 6 pages long, yet each is beautifully crafted and adds something to the tale. He introduces us to the flagpole skater, Mary Talbot, who gives parties for the local cats, and the lonely gopher, all complete and perfect little vignettes that together give us a lasting sense of place.
Monterey is a city with a long and brilliant literary tradition. It remembers with pleasure and some glory that Robert Louis Stevenson lived there. Treasure Island certainly has the topography and the coastal plan of Port Lobos. More recently in Carmel, there have been a great number of literary men about, but there is not the old flavour, the old dignity of the true belles lettres. Once the town was greatly outraged over what the citizens considered a slight to an author. It had to do with the death of Josh Billings, the great humorist. Where the new post office is, there used to be a deep gulch with water flowing in it and a little footbridge over it. On one side of the gulch was a fine old adobe, and on the other, the house of the doctor who handled all the sickness, birth and death in the town. He worked with animals, too, and, having studied in France, he even dabbled in the new practice of embalming bodies before they were buried. Some of the old-timers considered this sentimental, and some thought it wasteful, and to some it was sacrilegious, since there was no provision for it in any sacred volume. But the better and richer families were coming to it, and it looked to become a fad. One morning, elderly Mr. Carriaga was walking from his house on the hill down toward Alvarado Street. He was just crossing the footbridge when his attention was drawn to a small boy and a dog struggling up out of the gulch. The boy carried a liver, while the dog dragged yards of intestine, at the end of which a stomach dangled. Mr. Carriaga paused and addressed the little boy politely. "Good morning." In those days, little boys were courteous.
"Good morning, sir."
"Where are you going with the liver?"
"I'm going to make some chum and catch some mackerel."
Mr. Carriaga smiled. "And the dog? Will he catch mackerel too?"
"The dog found that. It's his, sir. We found them in the gulch."
Mr. Carriaga smiled and strolled on. And then his mind began to work. That isn't a beef liver. It's too small. And it isn't a calf's liver. It's too red. It isn't a sheep's liver. Now his mind was alert. At the corner, he met Mr. Ryan. "Anyone die in Monterey last night?" he asked.
"Not that I know of," said Mr. Ryan.
"Anyone killed?"
"Nope."
They walked on together, and Mr. Carriaga told about the little boy and the dog. At the adobe bar, a number of citizens were gathered for their morning conversation. There, Mr. Carriaga told his story again, and he had just finished when the constable came into the adobe. He should know if anyone had died.
No one died in Monterey, he said. But Josh Billings died out of the Hotel Del Monte. The men in the bar were silent, and the same thought went through all their minds. Josh Billings was a great man, a great writer. He had honored Monterey by dying there, and he had been degraded. Without much discussion, a committee formed, made up of everyone there. The stern men walked quickly to the gulch and across the footbridge, and they hammered on the door of the doctor who had studied in France. He had worked late. A knocking got him out of bed and brought him tousled of hair and beard to the door in his nightgown. Mr. Carriaga addressed him sternly. "Did you embalm Josh Billings?"
"Why, yes."
"What did you do with his tripus?"
"Why?"
"I threw them in the gulch, where I always do."
By the time he wrote Cannery Row, Steinbeck was a well-known and successful author, having already won the American National Award for Fiction and the Pulitzer Prize for The Grapes of Wrath. It was impossible for him to return to the easy, relaxed life he'd enjoyed in Monterey before the war, especially following the death of his close friend, Ed Ricketts, the model for Doc in the book, in 1948. In the 1950s, the city of Monterey changed the name of Ocean View Avenue to Cannery Row, cementing its fame forever in the hearts of Steinbeck's readers, and Doc lives on in the Pacific Biological Laboratory at 740 Cannery Row, which is now owned by the city and open to the public for guided tours. The world around him was changing, but in Cannery Row and the sequel Sweet Thursday, which was published in 1954, Steinbeck has preserved a lost place and a lost way of life for us to share and enjoy. I first read Cannery Row one rainy week in the school library, and it's been one of my favourite books ever since.
Strokes affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. Here's a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium.
Hang on. Slow down. And one tablespoon.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was the recipe?
Oh, if you would like a more simple solution, you can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondence from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch and a team of top writing talent.
Quite right, too. So, we've just been listening to clearly Jenny
Views on Cannery Row by John Steinbeck. The return of John Steinbeck, of course, after we covered Of Mice and Men a few weeks back, a few months ago. Rob Nichols is with us, and we also have a special guest with the Reverend Marie Edwards also with us. Marie, very close last week with your prediction, which, of course, we gave full coverage to as far as Fly Me to the Moon, our sister podcast and program, was concerned. You suggested it's going to be a 3-1 victory to Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
I'd gone 4-0. Rob was 2-0. Always good at half time.
Yeah, it was.
And of course, goals were scored. And you now look to actually take on board another side, either from Yorkshire or from Lancashire.
Yeah.
Where's it going to be? If it's Bravo in goal, then you probably just have to get the shot on target. And you'll, we'll move on that for Fly Me to the Moon. The cup special that we'll be having in a couple of weeks' time, I think, Rob.
Yeah.
What did you make of Cannery Row, John Steinbeck's?
I love Steinbeck's books. Yeah. And I hadn't read Cannery Row before. Mm. And it's as Jenny says, a joy to read. And just the characters and the description, and it's just the ease, the way that you flow through the book, and the sort of especially the Mac and the boys, their sort of tragic attempts to
put on a party.
Yeah,
if only
yeah.
They'd taken some of the views of Mary Talbot, all would have been sorted out.
Yeah,
put on a party with just cut out shapes of images. Put on a party for cats. I enjoyed it. I'm not necessarily the world's greatest Steinbeck fan. Mm-hmm. I think he's probably because it's the old notion of don't believe the hype. Because I've had so much people still saying how wonderful and authentic he actually is as a writer. It's kind of coming to him now. I see that actually the skillfulness is certainly there, and in terms of the easy, it's a poetic aspect. I mean, I'd probably say yes. Just as Ray Bradbury for me manages to echo in a science fiction fantasy world the same kind of, it's almost a lost America, an America that we look back on as being, yes, very much part of our kind of experience of a part of America, but without the drive-by shootings, without the racism, without the sort of problematic that's actually in there, but basically a new nation, a nation that effectively is just 50 years after its own civil war. Yeah. Kind of coming to terms with itself, and that America really of movies done by the likes of Frank Capra, the sort of notion you could encounter Jimmy Stewart's sort of George character sort of coming out of the store in various ways. I mean, in fact, I could have thought Jimmy Stewart could have made an ideal Doc if we were casting at that sort of time from that perspective. Jenny, you were saying that this book had been banned in your family, although one or two sort of relatives actually said it was not appropriate.
Yes, my grandmother caught my mother reading it and decided, particularly because of some of the settings, it wasn't suitable and took it away from her. I encountered it in the school library when I started on the left-hand side of the Steinbeck shelves with The Pearl and read right through everything he wrote and came across Cannery Row in the middle.
So has he influenced your own writing? Because, I mean, I do get a sense in terms of the descriptions that you put forward for Alex Hastings and the whole quadrilogy as it's developing and so on, that you often manage to encapture in a few sentences the sort of things that Steinbeck also does, where we're introduced to characters who may not have a major part to play, but they're still kind of, as you said, important character studies.
Thank you. That's a lovely compliment. I would like to think that's the case. I read a lot of Ray Bradbury and a lot of John Steinbeck when I was young, and I think in some ways the stuff you read when you're young stays with you, and it gives you a rhythm to your language, and maybe that's where the similarity lies.
Yeah. Rob, clearly the other aspect that Steinbeck does is he deals with societies, if not outcasts, and people who are slightly not necessarily, either for genetic reasons, either because of reasons of their own experiences and so on, but just as, you know, obviously Mice and Men kind of clearly puts this together, some of those I found quite heartwarming and heart-moving in terms of the way the lad who effectively sort of is put away because he steals and he, you know, his intentions there. It's that kind of understanding. Maybe in the 21st century, there are a number of politicians who could actually learn a lot from Steinbeck's views.
Yes, maybe. Yes. Maybe it would be do some of those politicians good to live in a pipe for a while
understand, I mean, you mentioned obviously the characters who kind of built their own sort of side of things, and the Asian grocer and the interconnections from that and the collections of frogs and so on.
It is, as you said, it's a
world away from Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, isn't it?
Yes, it is a world away. It's the other coast for a start, but it is a different world. And as you say, yeah, it's quite true. It is not long after the American Civil War, so it is a new country coming together, especially in the West Coast, which has been part of Mexico, hasn't it? Yeah. And there is a tolerance here where certainly on the behalf of Doc, who puts up with all these people floundering around
with
him.
With, of course, the one challenge, of course, when he returns for his first party treat.
Yes.
And tends to lose it, I think, to be fair.
I think it's fair enough,
this
really.
This is a big time. Mm. But, again, an interesting thing. Did we ever find out what happened to the image of the child or the female who was sort of seen under the water when Doc was collecting stuff? Or was that just put there as a kind of mermaid?
A kind of mermaid thing.
That was I sensed that. That was the one which, for me, I thought it was a narrative trope that was left hanging without necessarily the gopher sort of scenario. Also, flagpole skating. I wasn't sure about a health and safety issue with that. But I do seem to recall actually looking for skating records and going with the classic line of how would they actually spend a penny if they're doing all that amount of time?
Yeah.
And the denouement for that was particularly effective, I thought.
Yes.
That was nicely put together.
I like the comparisons to, you know, looking back at Middlesbrough when it was about 50 years old.
Yeah.
And the way that people had come from all over to Middlesbrough and the sort of entertainments they had with actually Wild West shows coming over here. And, of course, the famous the Indian that dies having been here for 2 days. And I think it's 10,000 people go for his... on the streets for his funeral. So you see those sort of things.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Rob, because that's exactly the kind of resonance that if you look back over the times past publication, which obviously ceased to be now in an ironic sense from the Gazette, but looking back over
Remember When
and so on, those sort of aspects, you do see a lot of comparisons. And I've often said that unlike
family stores, things like that,
the Infant Hercules, Victorian Milton Keynes, there's a kind of an American element to Middlesbrough in terms of its frontier newness and novelty. I mean, bringing Marie on this sort of basis, does that resonate with yourself, Marie, or do you think, no, we've got nothing in common with California at all apart from the weather?
Well, I mean, I've been to America. I've not been to California, but I've been to America, and lots of things were similar when I was there as to over here. So, yeah, I think cultures learn from each other all the time, and copies maybe is too strong a word, but do things similar all the time because they see what works in other places and they just give it a go and see what happens, yeah.
One of the elements about Canary Row, which I think is particularly interesting, is the descriptors of how the mini industry rose and then kind of fell apart over a relatively short period of time.
Yeah.
And also prior to the whole onset of not just commercialization, but the globalization effects of conglomerate companies taking in. I mean, you know, one absence that we have, you know, there's no mention of the fast food restaurants, companies, etc. We've clearly got people trying to make their way there. But it's all, I mean, do we look back over that as a nostalgic past, which you think, well, it was okay, but...
I think it was in many ways, it was a much simpler life. You can read Canary Row and go, now that's real care in the community, because everybody did look out for everybody else and help everybody else, but that's a very strong idealistic theme
find. Big society.
Yeah, the big society. Good grief. But you find that in The Grapes of Wrath and in most of Steinbeck's works, and this was one of the things that he believed in and he wrote about a lot.
And this is something that, of course, he wrote after the epic of Grapes of Wrath, so it was back to a slightly more, say, manageable, but sort of shorter, more poignant sort of aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Favourite character, Rob? From Canary Row?
I liked Mac and the boys. I'm putting them all together because they all had different things to offer.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Darling was. I mean, I was almost beside myself in tears when Darling is about to actually sort of pop her clogs, but thankfully managed just to be rescued. You know, that's a wonderful collective way. I thought Dora did very well, and Doc, apart from when he actually lost it, I think it was okay. Yeah. Lost his temper, I should say. Jenny, your favourite?
Dora.
Right. Yeah.
It's interesting to see such a strong central female character. In a lot of Steinbeck's works, you don't get that. Mm. In Of Mice and Men, Curly's wife is always called Curly's wife. She never even gets a name. Yeah. And it's really nice to see Dora is so important and so central to everything.
Marie, on the basis of what you've heard, will you be picking up a copy of John Steinbeck's Canary Row in the near future?
Well, it sounds very interesting. I like books that might make you laugh, so it sounds like it might be quite a funny one to read. So
and make you cry as well, that has to be said.
Well, yes, anything that kind of evokes emotion, I don't mind that, yes. So, yeah, sounds interesting.
Okay. Which brings us, of course, to the scores. So, Rob?
Nine.
I'm going to go 9 as well. I mean, I was really thinking, could I push it any higher? But as I said, I think the gopher, which I think he could have actually gone quite... I know you were saying it's a metaphor for the whole thing, but I thought, no, it's a really... And so I'll go 9. Jenny?
I'm going to give it 9.5 because I like the gopher.
Oh, there you have it. We're changing our life forms, possibly, but we're changing our genres. We're moving back into speculative fiction. We might even, Jenny, be actually changing our particular host for a one month special, just as Rob obviously did a special for yourself. It may well be that the script will actually be presented by somebody completely different as well.
It may well be.
We're changing location as well, Marie Rob. So we won't even be in the studio. So we changed the location. We changed the whole... We're changing everything. It's like a spring clean for the Book of the Month.
It's a whole new program. Yeah. Jenna Warren is going to feature Deborah Installs a Robot in the Garden in a programme that will come from the new book corner in Saltburn following her grand opening on the 4th of March.
So you see not only a new location, a new book corner, a new Saltburn thing, it's all new, Rob. Thankfully, Flower to the Moon will maintain its position in life in terms of consistency.
Old.
I prefer Chronologically Gifted. It will be back as well, as will Marie Edwards. And that's at Canary Row, John Steinbeck's Book of the Month. I think John would be pleased if he's looking. I think he'd be happy for that point of view. Good stuff.
You're listening to Jenny Finch, crime writer, scholar, and commentator, with another classic Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting.